This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Sources tell the Associated Press the Biden administration has decided to provide cluster munitions to Ukraine. We'll get more on the story from the AP's Ed Donahue.
Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryder would not comment on the AP report.
I will say that we have multiple variants of DPICMs in our stocks, and the ones that we are considering providing would not include older variants with dud rates that are higher than 2.35%.
The controversial bombs can cause civilian casualties. Reducing dud rate means there would be far fewer unexploded rounds that can result in unintended civilian deaths.
155-millimeter DPICMs have higher dud rates, so we would be carefully selecting rounds with lower dud rates, for which we have recent testing data.
Cluster bombs are weapons that open in the air and are intended to wreak destruction on multiple targets at once. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The United Arab Emirates has pledged to give $15 million to help rebuild the Jenin refugee camp after the most intensive Israeli military operation in the occupied West Bank in nearly two decades. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers has the story.
The promise of funding comes after the two-day offensive massively damaged the area's roads and alleyways. The operation sent thousands of people fleeing their homes. The Israeli military has said the intention of the fierce incursion was to crack down on Palestinian fighters after a series of attacks on Israeli settlers. Local UAE media has said the funding will go to the UN agency that assists Palestinian refugees, the UNRWA, which has recently struggled with funding. I'm Karen Chamas.
And for details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States remains active in its search for a country to head a multinational force in troubled Haiti. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Thursday without offering Washington's lead. Blinken met Wednesday at the Caribbean summit with Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry and again spoke of the urgency of an international force in the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation, where gangs have taken over broad stretches of territory. But no country has stepped forward, despite nearly a year of calls for the force by Haitian Prime Minister Henry and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Haiti's foreign minister addressed the Security Council on Thursday to reiterate the urgency of the government's appeal, saying the council has a moral responsibility to prevent, in his words, the shipwreck of his country. OceanGate, the U.S.-based company that managed the tourist submersible that imploded during a dive to the wreck of the Titanic, has suspended all exploration and commercial operations, its website showed on Thursday. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner has more.
OceanGate did not elaborate on matters beyond a red banner at the top of its website. The company lost contact with its Titan submarine on June 18th during a dive to the wreck of the Titanic, prompting a massive undersea search for the vessel. The U.S. Coast Guard last week recovered presumed human remains and debris from the sub on the ocean floor. Examination of the debris is expected to shed more light on the cause of the implosion. U.S. and Canadian authorities are investigating the cause of the disaster, which raised questions about the unregulated nature of such expeditions.
Freddie Joyner reporting. A toddler has died after her parents left her in a hot car overnight following the 4th of July festivities in Florida. AP's Lisa Dwyer has that story.
The Polk County Sheriff's Office says Lakeland parents Joel and Jasmine Rondon have been charged with aggravated manslaughter of a child following the death of their toddler left in the car overnight after a 4th of July party. Authorities say the Rondons accidentally left the 18-month-old girl in her car seat while they removed their two other children and unloaded their vehicle after arriving home. Joel discovered his toddler unresponsive in the car the following morning, and she was declared deceased at a nearby hospital. Joel Rondon tested positive for methamphetamines, marijuana, and alcohol. His wife tested positive for marijuana and alcohol as well. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
And for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's Raila Odinga calls for another anti-government protest today, Friday.
Even though our constitution is very progressive and it gives the right to demonstrate, the issues that Honorable Raila Odinga is raising cannot be effectively addressed through the demonstrations.
Nigeria's electoral body begins a review of controversial elections amid court challenges. Anticipation bills in Liberia for Monday's speech by a provocative political commentator and radio talk show host Henry Costa on the 2023 elections. The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan says the country is not ready for the 2024 elections.
I shared the frank views expressed by some government officials, political parties, civil society, and many of you here in this plenary that South Sudan today is not yet ready to roll out free, fair, and credible elections.
And today, July 7th, is World Kiswahili Day. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Kenya, Raila Odinga, the leader of the main opposition party, Azimio La Umoja One Kenya, has called for a new anti-government protest today, Friday. The demonstration coincides with the formation of Saba Saba, or the July 7th movement against one-party rule in Kenya 33 years ago. Odinga says Friday's protest will be over government taxation without the consent of the people. The Nairobi police have warned against what they called an illegal gathering. Kenya's political analyst Joseph Kioko tells me that Odinga's latest agitation cannot resolve the challenges facing the country.
What the Honorable Raila Odinga is doing is really engaging in extra legislative approaches to resolving issues that, in truthfulness, cannot be resolved. This agitation cannot resolve the challenges that are facing the country. The president and the deputy and his cabinet have been very clear on the fact that they inherited an economy that was in a mess. We were already in a hole. And the solution is not to keep digging. It is to get into some of the innovative approaches that the leadership has provided. Now, the Honorable Raila does not believe in that. He thinks that a demonstration can resolve some of this problem. But I think he's adapting a little bit outdated methods. Even though our constitution is very progressive and it allows and it gives the right to demonstrate, to hold meetings and to picket, but in the current circumstances, the issues that Honorable Raila Odinga is raising cannot be effectively addressed through the demonstrations.
Of course, the latest reason for the protests, according to Mr. Odinga, is the issue of taxes. He claims that President Ruto is imposing taxes on the people without their consent.
I think we need to understand, to have a holistic view about this discussion, in that you cannot live beyond your means. When the president and the leadership of this country was sworn in, they made it clear that we had borrowed outside of our means. We had overborrowed. The country was indebted to so much. Now, the solution to debt is to pay. And we must pay and live within our means. So yes, there are a lot of taxes that have been introduced. But if you are not to pursue this perspective of taxes, the solution is to go and borrow more and more and put this country into more debt and debt and debt. Now that is irresponsible leadership.
So the police in Nairobi, they are warning against the protest. That is a recipe for confrontation.
Yes, you know, the challenge about the call of demonstration by Azimio leadership is that it naturally morphosizes into rioting. Now, that it's a very fine line to say you are picketing and demonstrating legitimately, and also the question of security to private property.
Joseph Kioko is a Kenyan political analyst. You are speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, also known as UNMISS, says South Sudan is now ready for elections based on some incomplete tasks contained in the country's revitalized peace agreement. However, South Sudan's Minister of Cabinet Affairs says progress has been made and insists that the country has put in place laws and institutions required for the conduct of proposed elections. For VOA News, Mayang David Mayar reports from Juba, South Sudan.
Speaking at the 30th monthly meeting of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or IJMEC, in Juba on Thursday, Nicholas Asom, who is also the special representative of the UN Secretary General, said South Sudan's leaders have not created a conducive political and security environment for conducting elections.
In my engagements in New York, I shared the frank views expressed by some government officials, political parties, civil society, and many of you here in this plenary, that South Sudan today is not yet ready at this point to roll out free, fair, and credible elections.
Asom says lack of political will, adequate resources, and a commitment to create a suitable political environment impede South Sudan's ability to conduct a credible elections by 2024.
I echo the call made by IGAD last month, urging the national legislature to expedite the reconstitution of the National Elections Commission and the Political Parties Council.
Martin Elia Lomoro, South Sudan's Cabinet Affairs Minister and Secretary General for the High-Level Implementation Committee, says the transitional government of national unity is making progress in preparing for elections.
Under the National Constitutional Review Commission, we have received a draft budget for the commissions to operate. We have also sent a message to all the parties to submit the list of their representatives to this commission.
Lomoro says the draft bill for the Political Parties Council is ready and the political parties are now working on nominating their representatives at the council. The chairperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, a body monitoring South Sudan's 2018 peace agreement, says the parties have little time left for completing all the tasks in the peace deal. General Charles Taigi Twai says his office is worried about the slow pace at which the parties are moving as they implement the tasks in the agreement.
I would like, therefore, to make the following recommendations to Aratigino. Provide adequate and predictable funding for the implementation of the all critical pending tasks of the agreement.
South Sudan is scheduled to hold its first elections in December 2024. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayor in Juba.
Nigeria's Electoral Commission this week began its review of the general elections held in February and March of this year. Tuesday's meeting in the capital focused on the preparation, conduct, and aftermath of the process. Presidential and local voting were marred by violence and technical glitches and were considered one of the most controversial in the country's recent history. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
This week's meeting of the Independent National Electoral Commission INEC Chair Mahmoud Yakubu with state electoral officials marked the beginning of a month-long review of the outcome of the general elections in Nigeria. While praising INEC's successful deployment of the voter accreditation system, Yakubu said INEC will evaluate its operations and the effectiveness of technologies used in the process. Yakubu said the exercise will be carried out without bias and that INEC will make its findings public. Yakubu spoke to journalists in the capital.
The time has come for introspection, stock-taking, review and evaluation. Since the conclusion of the election, diverse opinions have been expressed by political parties, candidates, observers, and the Commission welcomes all of them, insofar as their purpose is to improve the future conduct of elections and to consolidate our democracy.
Officials said INEC so far has received 54 reports from various observer missions regarding the way in which the election was conducted. The reveal is beginning a week after the European Union Observer Mission published its final report on the elections, prompting some debate. The EU said elections did not ensure a well-run, transparent, and inclusive democratic process that INEC had promised. It also said public confidence and trust in INEC were severely damaged during the presidential poll and were not restored in state-level elections. The report also cited security issues, noting the political atmosphere was exceptionally tense prior to the election. But the Nigerian presidency this week rejected the EU's report. But Hidayat Hassan, director at the Center for Democracy and Development, says the report was right to cite an already challenging political environment even before the elections.
INEC overpromised and they underdelivered. Nobody is taking that away.
Review of elections should take into cognizance the prevailing factors surrounding these elections.
But Hassan says INEC must carry out the review in a broader context, including previous elections and its collaborations with security agencies and other stakeholders. Yobiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 7th. And for more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. In Liberia, anticipation is building for Monday's speech by political commentator and radio talk show host Henry Costa. Costa, once an avid supporter of former Vice President Joseph Boakai, has been silent since Boakai named a running mate for the October presidential elections. There has been speculation that Costa was not pleased that Boakai did not choose him as his partner in the race. There are also rumors that Costa could announce his support for another candidate. Costa tells me that while he does not want to let the cat out of the bag before Monday's speech, one thing is clear, he will not be endorsing the re-election of President George Weah.
Since Ambassador Boakai named his running mate, we have been consulting, reflecting, and discussing. And so it's high time we broke our silence so that we can give our people direction on what we're going to be doing.
You mentioned the former Vice President Joseph Boakai. You have been a supporter of him, but then people want to know, are you going to announce that you will be supporting his candidacy?
I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag just yet, but that particular press conference on Monday will definitely answer that question. And as you may well be aware, you know, we were his biggest supporter. And so that is what Monday's press conference is essentially going to center around. And about why we were silent for as long as we were, a few months. And people find my silence very concerning because we're not known to be a silent person. So the Monday's press conference will lay out the way forward for us and to give people a fair appreciation of what happened. What happened exactly to address the misconceptions that went on unabated.
You mentioned your silence, and that has led to so much speculation. One of the speculations is that people think that you are going to be announcing that you are going to support President George Weah's re-election.
Absolutely not. That's the only cat I can let out of the bag. That's the one cat I can let out of the bag. This platform is way too big to let that continue to simmer on. But no, we're not going to be announcing that we're going to be supporting George Weah. Absolutely not, Mr. Boakai.
Well, thank you for that. At least we have one cat out of the bag.
Definitely. Thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to speaking with you to do a real full interview after we speak, after the press conference.
Yeah, but I have one more question now. You mentioned you've been an enthusiastic supporter of the former vice president, and you mentioned speculation about a fallout. Has there been anything called fallout with the vice president?
Well, Mr. Boakai, I will be addressing that, but this much I can say, things are not the way they used to be, but I will give the full picture. Yes, so I may not choose to use your choice of word fallout, but things are not the way they used to be.
Okay, that's reasonable. You mentioned speculations, all kinds of speculations. What would you say have been some of the speculations?
Well, Mr. Boateng, I'm pretty sure you must have heard some of them. You know, some people think we're angry because we were not picked as his running mate. That's one of the speculations, which is incorrect. Some people think we've abandoned the former vice president because we are angry or were angry that we were not picked. That's also false. So Monday's press conference will definitely address all of those issues, and people will come to understand and appreciate why we were silent and why we have been silent.
Henry, thank you so much. Even though you did not release some of the cats out of the bag, at least we're able to see the tails. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You drive a hard bargain.
That was Liberian political commentator and radio talk show host Henry Costa. He was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. More African nations will soon be getting a life-saving malaria vaccine. UNICEF is working with the World Health Organization to procure a total of 18 million doses of the first-ever malaria vaccine for the African countries that are involved in the program. UNICEF's immunization director, Ephraim Limango, described the rollout of the vaccine to viewers Carol Van Dam.
This is the first ever malaria vaccine that we have. It's called RTSS, and the trade name is Mosquirix, and it's manufactured by GSK, who are based in the UK.
How many countries in Africa will be getting it?
Yes, first of all, I would like to say that the number of countries that has expressed interest to introduce the vaccine is very high. We have more than 28 countries on the continent that are interested at the moment in introducing the vaccine. We have supply challenges, and so we have developed a framework to allocate the available number of vaccine doses to the countries in a way that is fair and equitable. Now, applying that framework, it's 12 countries that are going to get the vaccine at the moment. Three of those have been receiving the vaccine under a pilot program, and those are Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi. And they have been implementing the vaccine for more than 3 years. They started in 2019, and so they have quite some experience. The other countries, the newcomers, they are nine, and they are Benin, Burkina Faso, Burundi, Cameroon, DRC, Congo, Liberia, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Uganda. So that makes it a total of 12 countries.
UNICEF Chief Immunization Director Ephraim Limango, he was speaking from New York to my colleague Carol Van Dam. Today, July 7, is World Kiswahili Day, an international observance introduced by UNESCO 2 years ago. Kiswahili is a widely spoken language in sub-Saharan Africa and one of the official languages of the African Union, the Southern African Development Community, and the East African Community. It is also ranked among the 10 most widely spoken languages in the world, with over 200 million speakers. Munini Nyanga is a veteran Kenyan broadcast media practitioner and educator. He tells me that Kiswahili is a language that promotes unity.
One of the things that I think right now is clearly understood, it's the only African language that has been given the special seat at the UN. I think that was one of the biggest milestones for the language itself. In the AU, it is an official language, so therefore recognized, and we believe that was also important, so that when the African leaders meet, those that feel comfortable to articulate themselves in Swahili would actually do it. In Kenya, I think we are also advantage because it is also an official language, meaning it can be used in parliament, in official document, in official communication. And I think that in itself has given it the kind of pedestal that is required to give it the leverage it needs to grow.
We understand the language itself played an important role in Kenya's struggle for liberation, also Tanzania. What can you tell us?
I think the one thing that is clear is that language is the best form of expression for any human being. It carries their heritage, it carries their emotion, it carries their passion, it carries their political ideology. And the fact that it clearly lends itself to those who are not the elite gives it a unique position for people to be able to articulate and agitate and even formulate the kind of leadership, the kind of culture, the kind of education that they need to have. And Kenya and Tanzania, actually the East African region, has been almost the bedrock of the language. And as you go down to parts of Central and South Africa, there are, because of historical migration, you will find speakers. DR Congo, you will find speakers in Mozambique.
You mentioned East Africa. I read last month, I think so, a debate in the East African Parliament about whether Kiswahili should be used as the working language of the East African Parliament. And according to what I read, some countries rejected that.
Yes. I think politics aside, because when it comes to matters of administration, there will be people who will be articulating issues from different standpoints. But the language in itself does a lot of justice to the people who are sitting there to be represented. And not only that, one of the biggest things that we as media practitioners in Kenya have also been urging our own government is that on serious and important days such as the budget making and budget reading day, it is important that the estimates are given in Swahili, because it is the language that lends itself to the people who you are expecting to pay the taxes and also to agitate for development.
You know, Munene, before I let you go, I'm going to show you my Kiswahili language speaking skills. So I like to say jambo.
Jambo sana mimi.
That was Munene Nyanga, a veteran Kenyan broadcast media practitioner and educator. You are speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in South Africa, where Malawi completed a First Council of Southern Africa Football Association COSAFA Cup victory over defending champions Zambia since 2015 with a crucial 1-0 success in their Group B clash at a vibrant King Zwelithini Stadium in Durban on Thursday. An own goal from unfortunate Zambia defender Aaron Katibi settled the contest in favor of the Flames, but the game could have gone either way as both sides had chances for more goals after that. In other games, Comoros swept aside Seychelles 3-0 in the first game of the day in Group B, their biggest ever victory in the regional competition. It is in fact the first time Comoros had won a COSAFA Cup game by more than a single goal. Group C will get underway on Friday at the same venue with a Lusophone derby between Mozambique and Angola that is sure to be a fiery affair. Friday's first game of the day will see Mauritius take on Lesotho. In women's football, Super Falcons fitness coach Kyle Quigley says he will assess the team's fitness and vigor over the weekend. The Super Falcons are currently in Australia as they prepare for the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. The tournament will take place from July 20th to August 20th. The Super Falcons are in Group B alongside host team Australia, Republic of Ireland and Canada. And now to basketball. The National Basketball Association, the NBA, and the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, on Thursday announced that the 19th edition of the Basketball Without Borders Africa will be held at the American International School of Johannesburg in South Africa from July 28th to the 31st. This marks the 15th time and first since 2018 that the Joint Global Basketball Development and Community Outreach Program will be held in Johannesburg. Basketball Without Borders Africa 2023 will bring together 40 boys and 40 girls from more than 25 African countries to learn directly from current and former NBA, WNBA and FIBA players, legends and coaches, and compete alongside their peers from across the continent. Basketball Without Borders have reached more than 4,000 participants from 136 countries and territories since 2001, with 111 former campers advancing to the NBA or WNBA. And on to cricket. Coach of Nigeria's under-19 male cricket team, Daniel Jim, says the team is optimistic and has a chance to qualify for the 2024 under-19 World Cup in Sri Lanka. Coach Jim said the team, made up of 16 players, is currently training in Benin City, South Nigeria, ahead of the World Cup Africa Division 1 qualifiers. The World Cup qualifiers are scheduled for Tanzania from July 21st, with six teams expected to fight for a sole slot at the World Cup in 2024.
24. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Botti in Washington, wishing that you will